David Bowie and his influences and other stuff. Our guest today, Owen Devereux, is a professor of sociology and head of the Department of Sociology at the University of Limerick, Ireland. His research work is kind of divided. He has published extensively in music, on the media and on popular music, including books on David Bowie, Morrissey, the Smiths and Joy Division, and the Cranberries. It's a local band in Limerick. He's the author of the international best-selling book, Understanding the Media, which has been used as a course book extensively. And then the other side of his research work is media representations of poverty and inequality, which is a recurring focus in his research work over the last three decades. And he's co-founder and director of two research clusters in Limerick, the Popular Music and Popular Culture Research Cluster and the Power, Discourse and Society Research Cluster. And he's also a docent at our Department of Music, Art and Culture. In addition to his research work, he's also a creative writer. Owen, please.
Thank you, Webbo. So, good afternoon, and thank you for coming along to hear me talk about David Bowie. And it's lovely to be back in Ubáscula. It's nice to see the snow. Every time I email Urpo or other colleagues here, this is my one question. Is it snowing? Is it snowing? Is it snowing? So you welcome me with snow, and I'm delighted to see that. So I'm going to talk about David Bowie today, and I have a lot of slides and some material, and my preference is that I will give you the slides. So I will give a copy of all of my slides to Urpo, and he can circulate those. And there are some notes as well, and I will also give those to Urpo for you. If you are electing to do an essay in relation to David Bowie, I have given Urpo some readings. In particular, I have given him an e-copy of our book, David Bowie, Critical Perspectives. So Urpo will also distribute that to you. If I'm speaking too fast, tell me to slow down. I tend to talk quickly. So just wave if I'm talking too quickly. So what I propose we do is that we work from now till about 1:30, and then we stop for a short break. And in part two, I'm going to talk about a kind of a final aspect of David Bowie, which is to look at David Bowie's fandom. And in particular, I'm going to talk about some work I have been doing on fan responses to David Bowie's death and what happened when David Bowie died. My own relationship with David Bowie goes back a very long time. As a young man, a long time ago now, interested in punk rock. So 1977 was my big year for discovering music and getting excited about music. And I suppose in that context, David Bowie was this figure who survived punk rock, you know, because punk rock swept a lot of the old dinosaurs away, but David Bowie survived. And of course, very quickly I learned to look backwards and listen to New York Dolls and Lou Reed and Bowie, particularly the work that he was doing between 77 and 80 in Berlin. And from there, my interest grew to become a lifelong interest in Bowie's work. So in Limerick, we had a seminar on the Smiths and on Morrissey before he started spouting racism and racist ideas and populist ideas. And we decided in 2012 to hold a conference about David Bowie. And you remember David Bowie had disappeared. David Bowie had been ill, he had some heart trouble, and he had very much gone underground in New York. He DJed a little bit. He He hung out with Arcade Fire. He, you know, curated exhibitions, but it was very, very low key. So we had no idea that he was going to reemerge in January, in January 2013. And my wife, who's a big music fan and a big David Bowie fan, by coincidence knew somebody who worked in David Bowie's organization. And so I made contact with them and said, I'm thinking of holding a conference about David Bowie. And I expected either to be ignored or maybe get a letter from his lawyers and say, don't have a conference about me. Why would you be doing this? And instead, something much more interesting happened. The Bowie organization got in contact straight away and said, whoa, this is really interesting. And the first thing they asked us was, there is a bronze statue on the plaza area in the University of Limerick, piece of public art. And within 24 hours, the Bowie organization asked us for permission to use this image to superimpose David Bowie's face on the image of what we call the Rusty Man, this piece of public art here. So we went on to hold the conference, and there were about 350 people there. They traveled from all over the world. And what was interesting was that as we were devising the conference, the Bowie organization put the material up on BowieNet and on his official social media channels. And then I started getting phone calls late at night because of the time difference with New York and Ireland. And so these questions started coming through, and it was clear that Bowie wanted all of the lectures videoed. So he wanted to hear what people were saying about his work. So we agreed to that. And then we got this request for any artwork we did. We made T-shirts, we had mugs, we had different things. And we got a request that the archive, that David wanted two of everything for the David Bowie archive. So you don't say no to David Bowie, right? So when the conference was over, we packed everything together and sent it off to David Bowie. And the book we did, David Bowie Critical Perspectives, came from that conference. And again, David Bowie got the first copy of that book. So it's been a kind of an interesting relationship at that sort of... in Ireland, we talk about people having a relationship which is twice removed. So it was that kind of relationship with his organization and ultimately with him. And again, the organization were very helpful in terms of things like copyright control about images and about lyrics for the book and so on. So we were very happy, and we had a very good relationship with the Bowie organization. So what I'm going to do in the seminar today is that I want to talk about Bowie at the beginning, and then in particular I want to talk about the wide array of influences David Bowie drew from. So he uses a whole series of reservoirs of ideas and thoughts and theory and writing. And I want to talk about that in general. And then in particular, I want to talk about his interest in the Irish painter Jack B. Yeats, a brother of the poet William Butler Yeats, and Bowie's interest, not often sort of publicized much, but Bowie had a particular interest in the Irish dramatist and writer Samuel Beckett. What ties Jack B. Yeats and Beckett and Bowie together is the clown, the figure of the clown. So I'm going to talk about clowning and where clowning came from and the way in which Yeats and Beckett and Bowie in particular uses the figure of the clown. And as we see today, I'm going to talk a lot about Pierrot, the clown, and Bowie's interest in clowning. And that discussion will be in the context of this much larger, older tradition of commedia dell'arte. So we'll pause there then for a short break, and then when I come back, and if you still want to come back and hear me talk about Bowie, I will come back and I will talk about fandom, Bowie fandom in particular. And I'm going to talk about some of the responses that fans had to Bowie dying, and indeed the kinds of cultural production that they engaged in. So as you'll see later today, there were sort of spontaneous shrines set up at various locations in the world that were associated with David Bowie. So I'm going to talk about that, and I'm also going to talk about the kind of things that fans said about Bowie and the significance that Bowie had for them in their affective, in their emotional lives. So, as a writer and a teacher and as a music fan, I've always been drawn to David Bowie. That's quite clear. His work engages, as you all know, with feelings of dislocation, of alienation. Bowie was a survivor who managed to overcome drug dependency and significant mental health issues through using his creative genius. His final album recordings, The Next Day and Black Star, deal openly and honestly with complex issues of existence and mortality. Excuse me, just one sec. Over five decades, Bowie managed to capture the zeitgeist, both culturally, politically, and spiritually, and speak directly to millions of people. In addition to being attuned to a wide canvas of musical influences, ranging from industrial, punk, electronica, hip-hop, drum and bass, and jazz, Bowie was a well-read and informed artist who drew upon a deep well of wider influences such as Buddhism, German Expressionism, philosophy, communications theory, mime, Oriental culture, and Jungian psychology. Bowie expertly utilized these influences and insights to create his own distinctive art. Bowie, not unlike Samuel Beckett, as we'll see later on, had the capacity to keep his fans and critics alike guessing. His real strength, I think, was his capacity to synthesize complex ideas and make ample use of them in his creative work across many art forms. His vast contribution as a songwriter, performer, recording artist, music producer, actor, film producer, and painter that meant that Bowie really, really, truly was a Renaissance man. Bowie's creative outputs were usually routinely multi-layered and replete with many, many intertextual references. And this was a practice that he maintained right until the very end. The outpouring of genuine emotions and grief by Bowie fans all over the world is testimony to the ways in which he touched so many people's lives. Fans, as we'll see in the second part of my talk today, strongly connect with Bowie as a result of the multifaceted way in which Bowie constructed himself. There are so many levels through which fans connect with Bowie. His ambiguity about sexuality and gender, his queering strategies, his, in quotes, outrageous image, his capacity to invent and reinvent personae, his wonderful lyrics and captivating sounds all contributed to the creation of a distinctive art. As the title of the beautiful 2013 exhibition at the London's Victoria and Albert Museum was titled David Bowie Is, this suggests that David Bowie is whatever we make of him. So one thing to think about David Bowie is that David Bowie didn't exist. David Bowie was a construct. David Bowie was, in fact, a man called David Jones, who performed as David Bowie, who in turn performed across a range of personae over time. So whether that is David Bowie, the spaceman, David Bowie, the otherworldly alien, David Bowie as Ziggy, Davy as the sort of cocaine-addled fascist, thin white duke, Bowie as Piero the clown, which we see at the very beginning of Bowie's career. We see it in his Ashes to Ashes phase. We also see Pierrot at the very end of how Bowie represents himself. Or David Bowie as straight David Bowie. So in the early 70s, he's talking about gender fluidity when nobody is talking about it. He's queering things when nobody is doing that. And then in the 90s, he emerges as straight, cleaned up David Bowie. No cocaine, no alcohol. Books, ideas become his new addiction. David Bowie as himself. And David Bowie, of course, as a trickster. So it's hard to kind of work out, you know, who are we trying to pin down in terms of trying to make sense of this man? And I usually start with my students by saying that David Bowie didn't exist. And he quite self-consciously was playful with his fans and with media about how he represented himself to the world. So I've seen him talk about different issues in his life, and then he laughs and says, well, maybe I'm lying. Maybe I'm joking. Who knows? You know, so all this time, kind of, you know, playing with people's perceptions of him. So we must begin, I think, by thinking about that. You know, which David Bowie are we talking about? We also need to recognise that David Bowie was a sort of cultural magpie. He picked and selected ideas from different kind of art forms, so whether it's Jungian ideas or whether it's the paintings of Jack B. Yeats or whether the imagery is from a Samuel Beckett play. He very cleverly brought different things together and synthesized these. People often talk about David Bowie as a chameleon. David Bowie wasn't a chameleon. David Jones was the chameleon, okay? It's often mistakenly referred to in that regard. And of course, it's Bowie the clown, and I'm going to say a lot about Bowie the clown, and indeed Bowie the trickster. So Bowie's ability to obfuscate, to cover his tracks in terms of the influences he drew upon, taking on new guises as a way of protecting himself, was an interesting set of strategies, but it was also sometimes problematic for him. So there are phases in, certainly in the 1970s, where persona that David Jones as David Bowie creates to perform overtake the man. So the Thin White Duke particularly is, and again that's associated with copious amounts of drug taking. And so the caricature, the character, the role he's playing, almost like a method actor, it has overcome and overtaken David Bowie. There's a very, very famous BBC documentary by Alan Yentob, and there's an interview with Bowie in his Berlin phase. And Bowie weighed, in old money, he weighed probably about 6 stone. He is like a skeleton. And he was basically living on cocaine and yogurt. So he's in the back of a taxi and he's eating yogurt, and he is like a living skeleton, right? And you know, latterly in his life, he would acknowledge that these persona had the potential to be problematic. And of course, his capacity to reinvent himself created the template for other popular music singers to do the very same. So nowadays, you will have people talking about Lady Gaga or Madonna. Oh, she has reinvented herself. Bowie did this long, long time ago, you know, shedding persona, coming back, looking different, and so on. So Bowie himself has talked about the idea that he was potentially revolutionary or a plagiarist, and that he drew really heavily from the ideas devised by other people. So I want to talk about this for a second. And Bowie had a really interesting relationship with Ireland. Now, Bowie was, you know, obviously traveled the world and drew about lots of influences from LA to Berlin and so on. And for obvious reasons, because I'm Irish, I became interested in his particular interest in Irish artists and writers and so on. And indeed, you know, Bowie spent a lot of time in Ireland recording and working and living indeed for a while. And we also know, of course, that Bowie's mother, Peggy Burns, was the daughter of an Irish immigrant. I've been doing some work with a colleague lately in terms of tracing Bowie's family line, and for a long time I thought Bowie came from, his family on his mother's side came from the southeast of the country, but I was really excited to learn lately that Peggy Burns's family, in fact, come just outside of Limerick, which is mind-blowing stuff for me, the idea that his great-great-great-grandfather on his maternal side, that they farmed land in the 19th century about 4 miles from where I live. So this is kind of interesting connection right back to not only Ireland, but to Limerick. So he had an interesting relationship with Ireland, and he had an affinity through his lifetime with Irish artists and writers, including painters like Louis Le Brocky and Colin Middleton. There is a very famous surrealist Irish writer called Miles Nagapaleen, Flann O'Brien, and Bowie had a particular interest in the work of Miles Nagapaleen, of Flann O'Brien, and he also, of course, had an interest in the work of Samuel Beckett, Spike Milligan, who was of Irish extraction, and, of course, the painter Jack B. Yeats. And the connection with Beckett and Yeats is particularly interesting. I mean, Yeats starts out as quite a conservative painter in the early phase of his career, and then shifts to expressionism. And it's that phase of Yeats's work that Bowie becomes interested in. And of course, Bowie himself, these album covers, this is for One Outside, Bowie, these are self-portraits by Bowie. There's a lot of work by Bowie that there are lots of parallels, particularly with German expressionism and connections in a variety of ways. So Bowie is an avid collector of paintings. He owned paintings by Jack B. Yeats. He owned paintings by Louis Le Brocky. That's James Joyce's head there by Louis Le Brocky. Sorry, my machine is going mad here. Okay, and he quotes Samuel Beckett directly on the album Earthling. He uses a phrase which Beckett's father was reputed to have said when he was just about to die, and that Beckett used in one of his novels, and Bowie makes use of that. Here's David Bowie talking about the work of Jack B. Yeats when he released an album in 1999. There's something about the life and death motifs in Jack B. Yeats' work that are maybe not dissimilar. So he was being asked to compare his music to a painting or to the work of a painter. Just to have that kind of work around me, I find, influences me tremendously. So Bowie bought a very famous painting by Jack B. Yeats called Sleep Sound. And this painting, erroneously, it has been said that it was influential in the writing of Waiting for Godot. Now, in fact, it wasn't, because Waiting for Godot was written before the painting was actually made. So what is interesting is that Bowie becomes very interested in the work of Jack B. Yeats, Colin Middleton and Louis Le Brocky, and these are part of his overall art collection. And he bought that painting that I've referred to called Sleep Sound by Jack B. Yeats in November 1993. And the painting is interesting because it refers to a poem also by William Butler Yeats, the famous Irish poet. So Bowie was really taken with this particular painting and had it behind him, in fact, in his home office in New York. He told an interviewer in 1999, I have a painting of his, of Jack B. Yeats, of two bums lying on a hillside sleeping. The apocryphal story is that it was one of the paintings which influenced Samuel Beckett when he was writing Waiting for Godot, which I'd love to believe. Now, Bowie's interest in Jack B. Yeats, I think, is particularly interesting because the painter, like David Bowie, David Jones, had a dual identity. He also performed or painted as a cartoonist known as Bird for Punch magazine. And like David Bowie, Jack B. Yeats was a proponent of outsider art. And the latter part of his career, which is sort of non-realist, impressionistic painting, seems to have been particularly appealing to Bowie. And just by coincidence, what is often interesting as well, if you look at the work of Jack B. Yeats, you will, in many of his paintings, come across references to the painter himself. So he'll paint himself into the painting, right? And equally, Bowie will do this. Bowie will reference things about himself in the wider canvas of what he is presenting. So Yeats appears in many of his own paintings, and Bowie regularly references many of his past identities in his creative outputs. So if you look at the last videos he made, they're a reference right back to the Thin White Duke. If you look at the video for the song Love Is Lost, he is using personae like Piero the Clown and the Thin White Duke. These characters reappear as mannequins, as dolls, in the paintings. Jack B. Yeats was a significant influence on Samuel Beckett, so the connection between the two of those, and both in turn were important influences on David Bowie. There are strong parallels between Yeats and Beckett and Bowie in that the figure of the clown is central to their work. And indeed, Jack B. Yeats examined, as a painter, he examined themes of mental illness, loneliness, politics, and social change. And a great deal of his paintings had to do with painting clowns, but also painting circuses. And a lot of the work he paints after the Holocaust, after World War II, is he paints a lot about circuses, but what he's painting about are around the movement, the migration of people who are seen as exotic, who are seen as mobile, who are seen as nomadic, who are seen as different, and so on. So there are lots of connections that Bowie saw in the work of Jack B. Yeats. And of course, the figure of the clown and masquerade for Jack B. Yeats is not just a subject, another subject in his work, it's a key to Jack B. Yeats' art. And as we'll see in a little while, it is also key to the work of understanding David Bowie. So I want you to think about this image because we're going to come back to this image later on when we look at some of the content from Bowie. Okay, this is probably one of the most famous Jack B. Yeats paintings. It's of a man called Johnny Patterson, and it's known as a clown singing. And again, look at the image there, and in a moment, and wearing the conical hat, something which Bowie uses a lot. As Piero across his career. Okay, so as I said, Jack B. Yeats and Samuel Beckett have a particular interest in clowns. The clown is seen as an avatar for the outsider artist. The clown is an avatar for the human condition, that sort of binary between being happy and being sad, of being connected or being alienated. Okay, so clowns are central to Beckett, as we'll see. the main characters in Waiting for Godot are arguably clowns. There are lots of clowns that appear in his work. Here's Beckett, one of the few films he directed with Buster Keaton, very, very famous clown figure, and so on. Lots of interest in clowning. This is from a Beckett play. Painted white faces and so on. So, I want to maybe... Okay, so Bowie had a particular interest in these Irish writers. And I think one of the things I'd like to stress at this point is that I mentioned it kind of in passing at the start there, that Bowie, when he cleaned himself up in terms of his lifestyle and so on, I mentioned, and I wasn't being flippant, I mentioned that one of the things that he became addicted to, in inverted commas, was reading. Okay, and I know from somebody who had a sort of close contact with Bowie, and I would have met him quite a number of times and worked with him and so on, that part of his entourage when he was touring in the 2000s, that his library went with him everywhere. So instead of drugs or alcohol or cigarettes or whatever, so there was a whole collection of books that he brought with him, right? And if you look at the books that he was reading, in the V&A exhibition, for example, he published a list of books that were influential on him. There was 100 books. And he has written about this as well. There's a very long article in The Observer magazine in the UK where he talks about books that influenced him. And again, if you look at what Bowie was reading in the 2000s and in the late 90s, he's reading everything from mass communication theory, he's reading philosophy, he's reading Jungian ideas, he's reading about psychoanalysis. He had a particular interest in the 70s in the occult, Aleister Crowley, so volumes and volumes of poetry, novels, fiction, and again within that, for my own sort of local selfish reasons, lots of Irish writers like James Joyce, like Spike Milligan, emerging in the list of books that Bowie read. And I think that's really interesting. I remember being in New York when Bowie was still alive and being near where he lived. And I was buying a book in a bookstore, and I was just chatting to the guy that was selling me the book. And I just said, David Bowie lives near here. And he said, yes, he comes in most days when he brings his daughter to school. And every day he'll come in, he'll buy an espresso coffee, but he will come in every day to buy a book. And he very quickly became this person who read a book every day. Like he read voraciously. And I think that shows. As I've begun to write academic articles about Bowie, I realize simply how much depth there is to him. So there is just so much to dive into in terms of understanding the ideas that he actually engages with. So of all of the things that I could talk about in relation to Bowie, I want to talk about this figure of the clown. And of course, it refers back to his interest in Yeats and in Beckett. But I want to talk about his interest in clowning. So here he is in 1976, and he says, "I am Pierrot. I am every man. What I'm doing is theatre and theatre only. Theatre, what you see on stage isn't sinister. It's pure clown. I'm using my face as a canvas and trying to paint the truth of our time on it. The white face, the baggy pants, there Pierrot, the eternal clown putting over the great sadness." So, what's Bowie at? Bowie is tapping into a much